It's great to be here at CEDAR, a think tank that's been advancing the cause for serious long-term economic reform over more than half a century. And I'm pleased to see that in line with today's prevailing ethos, you're continuing to do it tirelessly. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet for breakfast this morning. When I made my first major speech after I was sworn in as a minister last year, and just in case there's any doubt, Heather Ridout was there when I delivered it, I said that I would be happy to be described as the Minister for Productivity. I stand by that title now, and the pace of change since the delivery of that first speech has been rapid indeed. We've taken action on many fronts, from starting the abolition of work choices to bringing down the government's first budget. We've proudly delivered on our education revolution promises. We've passed legislation to end the creation of new Australian workplace agreements. We've published an exposure draft of our 10 national employment standards, and we've commenced the vital task of award modernisation. We've also commenced the delivery of our early learning agenda, including universal access to preschool and new assistance to help working parents meet the cost of childcare. We've signed partnership agreements to deliver trade training centres, and we've commenced the rollout of our digital education revolution. We have determined to address educational disadvantage and teacher quality through new Council of Australian Government partnerships. We've invested $11 billion in our Education Investment Fund, and provided $500 million this year for the renewal of our universities. We've commenced the Bradley Review of Higher Education to examine the long-term issues and opportunities facing the universities of this nation. My colleague Kim Carr has established the Cutler Review of Australia's National Innovation System. We've allocated the first 20,000 of our promised 630,000 adult skills places. We've established Skills Australia, our new vocational education and training leadership body, which will work with us, industry and COAG to deliver new investment and reform in VET. We've put forward a new model of employment services focused on achieving sustained participation in work, including for the most disadvantaged job seekers. We've established a social inclusion board and set its priority work program. And we have agreed through COAG an historic framework for collaborative reform of education and training systems, and it's only June. This morning, I want to address how all of these actions taken in the government's first 6 months fit together and where they might take us. We won the election by promising to focus honestly on the ordinary concerns of working Australians. Those concerns include the everyday prices of the goods and services that people rely on: housing, transport, childcare costs, groceries. They also included Australia's readiness for the future. We won because Australians recognise that we face new challenges which require a fresh, long-term approach. We argued that a successful nation would invest in its future through responsible economic management. We argued that climate change presents a major new challenge. And we argued that a human capital revolution is needed so that Australians are equipped to compete successfully in the global economy taking shape around us. In all of these areas, we argued that only by embracing innovation and reform would we develop the new infrastructure and capabilities required for success. And that's exactly what we've done. There are two important connections between the arguments of the last few weeks on petrol, the shortages of skilled labour, the prospects of post-drought recovery for our farmers, and the need to improve the educational attainment right across the life cycle. First, the current urgency of these issues reflects the failure of the previous government to properly prepare for the long-term needs of our national economy. Second, they reflect a deep set of changes going on in the structure of the world economy. Now, what are these shifts? Our record terms of trade reflect historic demand for Australia's mineral resources, driven above all by the bursting of China and India into the world economy and the enormous processes of development both nations are undertaking. This huge challenge, combined with other global uncertainties, is also driving demand for oil and energy resources. At the same time, Australians recognise that we face the challenge of climate change, and this involves putting a proper value on the natural resources, the so-called global commons, which we need for our lives and our economies to function. The global response to climate change involves developing markets in carbon emissions, which will create real incentives to reduce them. Third, the emergence of China, India, Brazil, and many other economies previously considered developing is leading to a repricing of goods, labour, and ultimately of knowledge. It's not just China and India, but Brazil and Vietnam, Chile and South Africa that are beginning to change the nature of global competition. Billions of people are joining global supply chains, and their competition is based only partly on the cost of labour and production. All these countries are also determinedly moving up the value-added chain. In fact, China and India are important export markets for Australia's education services, which is now our third largest source of export revenue after coal and iron ore. China has been increasing its investment in research and development by more than 20% over the last decade, and its share of world science publications has trebled. India is introducing more than 2 million graduates in science, technology, and engineering every year. Brazil is becoming a global hub for open source software production. These nations are rapidly becoming knowledge economies. These juxtaposed forces help to clarify Australia's economic challenge and its opportunity. While there is a record demand for our output, this global phenomenon is also driving inflationary pressures in the domestic economy through food and fuel prices. Our ability to grow our own productive capacity and to compete in these international markets depends increasingly on the supply of skilled workers, on the availability of specialist knowledge, and on our innovation performance. This is true in mining, in financial services, in manufacturing, in construction, in health, in hospitality, and in education. This shift is confirmed by Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, with his observation that value is increasingly created through the embodiment of ideas in products and services that consumers value. Ideas, in his words, are at the centre of productivity growth. Fundamentally, productivity is about getting more value out of the things we have, not just our knowledge and labour, but our capital, natural resources, and other business inputs. As Paul Krugman has said, productivity isn't everything, but in the long run, it's almost everything. It can lead to higher wages, increased leisure for employees, higher profits and lower prices. The rising revenue it creates allows governments to invest in education, public health, welfare and the arts. By creating goods faster with fewer resources using less energy, it can make our economy more environmentally sustainable. It is absolutely imperative that we do all we can to keep productivity rising as fast as possible. Unfortunately, of late, this has not been the case. Across too many fields where it would make a difference, education and training, workplace relations, welfare reform, sustainability, the Howard government's efforts were piecemeal, unfocused, inadequate, and directed to fighting the battles of the past. It continuously traded long-term advantage for short-term gain. The results are plain to see. During the most recent growth cycle, from 1998 to 2004, annual growth in labour productivity averaged just 2.4%. This is 1.2% below the record average growth of the preceding cycle when Labor was in office, and 0.3% behind the long-term average growth rate of 2.4%. Since the June quarter of 2004, annual productivity growth has been just 0.8%. And in the 2006-2007 market sector multi-factor productivity, in that time, multi-factor productivity declined by 0.6%. We know, because the Treasury has told us for several years, that stagnating productivity will have escalating consequences for all of us. This is not just because of the more intense international competition, but because of the impact of our ageing population. Standing still means going backwards. The Rudd Labor government is taking a different approach. Lifting productivity and participation together is essential for our future. Our approach seeks to learn from the successful reforms of the past and adequately square up to the economic conditions of the future. During the Hawke and Keating governments, Labor successfully laid the foundations of long-term growth by undertaking major structural reform. These reforms were all politically difficult at the time, but people now understand that they were key to improving our living standards. They expanded the opportunities and security available to working Australians so that they could participate with confidence in the challenging economic transition. Now we are embarking on the next transition. Multi-factor productivity growth is driven, as the term might suggest, by many different factors. Understanding the causal patterns in complex open economies is not easy. Exposure to competition, diffusion of new technologies, and labour market flexibility have all played their part. But the evidence is now converging around the central importance of human capital, knowledge, skills, and capabilities to future growth. My own department has estimated that a 1% increase in the proportion of the working age population with post-school qualifications would raise GDP by 0.9%. A recent Canadian study based on the OECD-sponsored adult literacy survey found that a country with literacy scores 1% higher than the international average will achieve a 2.5% increase in labour productivity and a 1.5% increase in GDP per capita. And a study of the Australian economy between 1969 and 2003 estimated that 31% of the annual increase in real GDP per capita was contributed by education. So we know that over long periods of time, the accumulation of knowledge and its application across our economy is fundamental to its performance. And we know that demand for specialist skills and knowledge are amongst our most pressing needs. But we also know that while education is central to human capital, simply increasing the supply of education will not automatically translate into higher growth rates. This is precisely because market economies are organised into complex, decentralised webs of production, innovation and exchange. So our challenge is not just to invest more in the supply side of human capital, but to radically improve the ways in which it is deployed and developed in the wider economy. In short, our strategy is to invest in people's skills and learning across the life cycle, from early years to post-retirement. It's to empower Australians to aspire to more and contribute more, to making meaningful choices about their own pathways through work and learning, and inspiring Australians to access the resources which will allow them to pursue those choices over time. Our challenge is to reform the institutional frameworks through which education and training services are delivered to create higher expectations, higher performance and higher capacity. Our challenge is to incentivise collaboration between governments and employers and others with a stake in productivity growth. It's to stimulate innovation in developing new ways of supporting participation and productivity. And our challenge is also to ensure that we share the proceeds of productivity growth equitably to make sure that it is reinvested in sustainable long-term growth. Of course, this will require reforms across both our labour markets and our education system. In all of the sectors I've outlined in this speech, the former Liberal government attempted reform. Most often it was described as market-based, a market-based approach justified on the grounds of choice and efficiency. In general, I think it is fair to say that they pursued market liberalisation wherever they could find a version of it. What often happened was that the former government sought to undermine existing forms of universal service by subsidising the creation of private sector competitors. For example, they created Australian technical colleges but failed to do the system-wide reform necessary to avoid the skills crisis. They used childcare benefit to develop a market for childcare which did not offer a consistent level of quality or work seamlessly with other early learning years services. They subsidised private health insurance and penalised those who stayed in the public system, but they did not build a long-term framework to ensure that health outcomes and value for money actually improved. They used Commonwealth funding to encourage the growth of private schooling, but left the issue of quality largely unaddressed. They created full fee places and bullied universities into adopting their preferred model of workplace relations. In my view, the results tended towards less equity, less efficiency, and underinvestment in essential shared infrastructure. But the lessons of these experiences is not to reject the workings of the market. It is that we should acknowledge the power of market competition in combination with a strong institutional framework and empowered demanding users. If we want our economic reforms to be productivity enhancing, we must focus on the fundamentals of market design to ensure that, in sector after sector, the design of key institutions and the shared investment in knowledge and skills happens in ways which increase the distinctive strengths and adaptability of that sector. Diversity and contestability of provision is one necessary feature of healthy, productive markets. So is the empowerment of service users and therefore the transparency of information in each market. Institutional arrangements to ensure that public infrastructure, shared investment and collaboration produce maximum return must be tailored to each sector while maintaining the principles of strong competition policy. What the systems and mix will look like will vary, but in each significant area of our economy, including those service sectors that supply education and learning, we need to focus on how to accelerate the process of successful market design and how to strengthen and grow those crucial public and collaborative institutions. Only a government with a balanced long-term perspective can pursue such an agenda. We intend to, and we will need the active contribution of the business community and of independent analysts and researchers in taking it forward. I know that you will be there providing your perspectives, and I look forward to hearing them. Thank you very much.